Which part did you lost the part where I'm telling the Burning Man story?
So basically what happens is you say you're at Burning Man, you're overdosed on acid, you're boiling hot, and you say you go to the temple, you say you didn't know what it was for, that it was for contacting spirits and or spirits of loved ones that had gone. You do say that you had I believe you say you had Book of the Law in your pocket, and you say that you're there and that there's this girl crying. And this girl won't stop crying and crying and crying, and you're trying and you're riding these waves of emotion. And then I look up, and that's where it cuts out. And
Oh,
then it
okay.
picks up with you saying, "And yet it was like the craziest thing. I've never had an experience like that." And I was like, "Well, what was the experience?"
Maybe it's supposed to stay blank. It's weird to like even talk about it because that at the time was like such a super that was like a real. Did you hear it at the time when I was saying, or did it just not record?
I might have. I overheard part of it. I wasn't. I mean, basically, I was just trying out my wife with something in the other room, so I had the speaker up, but I couldn't really hear it. So I know you said something about, where you read something, but I believe you also mentioned something about how you had connected it to. I assume that's where you made the connection between Crowley and Jim Morrison.
That's how that seed got planted. So, but particularly like what I read, I actually posted in the message to you recently. The it's titled Quest. You know, I've always been there for you. You know, I've always done everything I can do. The dreams a child dreams for himself cannot all come true. Please forgive me for those dreams I was unable to make real. And it's signed Jim Morris. But that was like, I mean, at the time, because there's thousands of things written all over the fucking place. And I'm like basically in a yoga pose on the dust on the floor, like rocking back and forth. And I look up and it's the only thing I read the whole, I got myself to not read anything else on the walls, but just read that. And I read it over and over and over again to myself. Like as I was sitting there, and like it had just like it felt so applicable, and it was like it felt personal, you know. And so I had that happen a few years later at the same temple experience where I said, I forgive all who have ever harmed me, even me. I just repeated it to myself, you know, over and over and over and over again, and ended up having a whole like basically I found that if there's like a key point of something that you need to get, you know, and if it's something communicates it, you know, you repeat it to yourself, it can have a really profound effect, you know.
Absolutely.
So, but the effect that this had, this was my first year, my first day at Burning Man. And I walked out and it was this message, you know, it was like for whatever reason, it put me into a space where basically it's hard to communicate. I didn't think that I was Jim Morrison, but I took on like I was talking as if I were Jim Morrison, and I wasn't even thinking about it in those terms. It was just something that just kind of happened. And I was, you know, I don't know. It was weird. I think my friends didn't quite know what to make of what was going on with me. But at Reno that year, afterwards, there's an after party at Reno, and I basically it was the same acid, and my friend had miscalculated it, and so for every hit, what he thought was a hit, there was actually four hits.
Oh, fuck.
And so the first day I took two hits, so that's eight. But then in Reno I took like at least six, and it was in orange juice. There was a big orange juice container, and I just chugged half the fucking container, and it was dosed with I think like 18 hits or something like that. And so I just, you know, I got higher than I'd ever been at a the biggest casino in Reno. And
a little fear and loathing for you.
Yeah, I was on like 24 hits of acid at least in Reno. It was weird. I like turned into an iguana. My friends gave me the nickname Bellows after that because I was breathing like bellows, which they didn't realize is the fool. Like from Latin, translates as bellows. That's the most direct translation of fool. And it's why we have the term, if someone's full of hot air, you say they're full of hot air. It's because bellows are what you use to start a fire.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because the fool is Aleph, which is the life breath. And then it's connected to Shin, which is the fire. So you have this whole, you know, what's keeping the fire going? It's the fool, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And to judge.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of nice as the fool is sort of like that touchstone moment where I had a realization the other day that, you know, it's the 22 trumps are an arrangement, is a way for us to sort of reboot. It's like the tarot is meant to be shuffled. It's not that there's a single monomyth. The monomyth is the touchstone. It's like the reboot. If you forget the archetypes, if you're trying to learn the archetypes, you can reboot them, put them in order, and it tells you the story. But they're not meant to be static. They're the reason that they're cards is so that they can be shuffled, and that's the whole idea. Mm-hmm. Is that we're supposed to be remixing and using these archetypes in different ways, but that they're there as a way to literally like reboot our system and go, okay, here, you can learn it this way and now mix it up. So to me, the fool is definitely that reboot, and it's like rekindling the fire. Like, how do you get the fire started? You start there. And even the symbolism on the fool card shows his staff extending from the sun, as if the fire of the sun is that sort of kundalini energy coming from his ball sack, essentially down his rod. Mm-hmm. But that's really interesting.
Yeah. Did you look at Alejandro Jodorowsky's book on tarot when he restores the Marseille tarot deck?
I've seen videos of him talking about it. I've never read the book.
So there's, I don't know if you've seen, he has this basically this mandala that he's formed from the Marseille tarot, which is still 78 cards. I mean, it's tarot, you know, but he arranges it in this way. I can send you an image of it, but it's really mind blowing. And his explanation behind it is pretty mind blowing too. Like how he came to it. It's pretty legit, but basically it's kind of hard to explain. But what I ended up extrapolating from what he did there, which is, it connects to the argument in certain ways that Crowley has for switching lust, which was strength, with justice, which is adjustment, to try and make the tarot tableau symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to all this trouble to switch things around, and you know, he gives a pretty good explanation as to why in the book of Thoth. You say Thoth, but I think it's actually Thoth. Actually,
it's Thoth. Yeah.
But anyways, there's this whole thing, and I've been tripping on it because it's this notion. It connects to the I Ching, which is one of Crowley's big things, was to try and figure out how tarot and the I Ching were not just mirrors of each other, but extensions of one another.
Correct, yeah. I see it the same
way. Which I think is like one of the most important things that he actually pointed out, which is like, you know, like that's talk about synchronicity, you know?
Yeah.
So, basically, it's this notion that when everything's aligned, when all the vectors are in place, and everything is counterbalanced to the most, you know, its possible ability, that we basically, at that point, we would be in a static place. But there's just a distortion that's required. But the idea here is that there is an order to the distortion, despite any appearances, right? So that the cards themselves are ultimately, everything is counterbalanced. There is, like, basically a web of basically vacuum dynamics. So if it existed as a torus or if it existed as a funnel, there's a way that things fall into place because of how they're ultimately connected. And because there is an ultimate equilibrium in the midst of the distortion, it's able to recirculate. So I look at tarot and I'm like, yes, it's meant to be shuffled. And the fact that everything can ultimately line up in a perfect order allows for a continual flow. Yes. And that actually, that's the argument that's given for why the Fool is zero. And you're like, Aleph, well, wouldn't you just follow the gematria and keep it as one and do the whole thing? And it's like, no, it's one removed. It's why, like, Oz and NY for New York, it's one removed. IBM, HAL. You move it over ever so, just like the major arcana, move it ever so from the numbers to create just the right amount of distortion to acknowledge that we're dealing with something that's circulating. And so the way that Jodorowsky lays out the tarot is actually, the mandala is actually suggestive of a wheel, and you see like a swastika in the center of it, the line going through the center. I'll show you what I'm talking about, but it's kind of crazy. It gives a really good argument. Then you have the cherubim, you have the four cherubim, and you basically are looking at the story of the garden and how it's guarded by the beasts, which are the four fixed signs of the zodiac. And so, you know, those extend out in this, basically this large mandala is what he refers to it as. But yeah.
Now, when you're saying this sort of cross or swastika in the middle, this would be in Garden of Eden, you're talking about the sort of rivers that intersect. And again, Oz, if you look at maps of Oz, Oz is laid out the exact same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it's a mistake. No, I also think it's a mistake that Crowley retitles the Nine of Wands strength. He gives it that title, and the Nine of Wands is what happens to rule Ophiuchus.
Yes.
So that what we'd say is the galactic center here, you know, basically that strength, Oz, the word Oz in Hebrew means strength. So he takes the major arcana strength, calls it lust, switches it over with justice, renames that adjustment, and then proceeds to take this minor arcana and just kind of, it's strength. It's so inconspicuous. Yet he's like, no, that's the center. It connects through to the center. They like, yeah, it's pretty ingenious. And those are both serpent letters too. That's the thing. You have Tet and then you have Lamed, both serpent letters of what was strength and justice.
Hmm. Now, I don't know what you were just talking. I'm thinking now, Folk Hey Dick's Adjustment Bureau, as now seeing that as adjustment, in that sense. But that's really interesting. But yeah, I like this idea. I mean, ultimately, when you were saying about this Taurus, I mean, this really ties into what I've seen. Just on meditating on these subjects is basically the exact same thing, that there is, I said, in my understanding, it is, I mean, I think we're saying the same thing using just a little different phraseology, but that you can return to that sort of balance point or you know, to center it, and to what I'm saying, sort of like reboot, is like you can go back to center to learn, and I think we always have to return back to center in any yogic practice, any tree of life, everything, you're trying to return to center, but that it allows for these different distortions or excursions away from center to kind of stir it up, and this is, I think, where creation comes from. You know, the even on the tree of life, creation doesn't come straight down the middle pillar. It sort of zigzags through. That's your lightning flash. So you need to sort of sway from side to side. It's almost like a yin-yang sort of back and forth. And that's how we create something, but you always can return back to center. So we see how the lightning flash comes down the center and then returns back to center at Malkuth. So I think ultimately Tarot, I Ching, it's like that there is a story there, so you can lay it out in a certain order. And the I Ching, of course, was made to be symmetrical, that they sort of paired it up with each of the hexagrams that are symmetrical to each other.
Right, well, so, 64, right? And then it's 64 tetrahedrons that make up an isotropic vector metric, which is perfect shape and geometry. It's like if you were to lay out three-dimensionally, you know, and take all of those lobes as tetrahedrons, what you'd end up with. You end up with 64, which is perfect. You have 64 hexagrams. It's not a mistake that they're hexagrams. And it's also not a mistake that they're in a circle surrounding the yin and yang, which is the torque.
I want to back up a second. Nine of Wands, but I think it's really interesting. The Ten of Wands, he's overburdened, right? The Ten of Wands is too much. So it's literally right. That one removed, bringing it back to nine, is where he's as strong as he can be without tipping over. And which, you know, this idea of the strength or lust card, the idea of sort of taming the beast, it's like you're taking something really powerful. It's literally that as strong as can be, but just toning it down one notch, sort of by adding the element of the female, adding that feminine that feminine figure that's sort of holding the lion's mouth, or however you want to take this, to basically tame it. And so it's just that tiny, like when you said one removed, sort of just take it down one notch, because if you bring it up to 10, now I'm thinking of Spinal Tap, but you know, when you bring it up to 10, that 10 wands, he's overburdened. And of course, we want to go up to 11.
Right. One and one in one. That's a great Tool song on Anima. Maybe the song is called 11, I forget. But where he says, one and one in one, 11, I'm wide awake and headed home. It's this whole realization. But then there's the argument that the Aught, in a sense, is the 11th Sphero. Right? So you actually are, in a sense, turning it up to 11, if you want to include that. But the amount of takes on Da'at from what I've read, there's a big difference. I was about to say there's a big gulf in difference between the old Kabbalists and the European Kabbalists, but that is like, that wouldn't have been an intended pun, but that's a pretty good pun. It's a gap. Basically, from what I've seen, Da'at is considered both thought and the universe.
Yeah.
So they would actually say that that is like a large palace where you basically wake up in a palace and you're in a room surrounded by six rooms in a circle. And you're looking at, well, which way do I go? And you open a door. And you go into the next room, and the next room is another room with six rooms in a circle. And that it just goes on like that, basically in a giant structure that never ends.
So I thought it was fascinating, this most recent Mask of God post. I believe it was Jason, or maybe you, but where all those images of showing the hexagonal doorway in 2001 Space Odyssey, showing the hexagonal doorway in Full Metal Jacket, showing the hexagon carpet in The Shining, showing the hexagon pattern behind the guy in Dr. Strangelove, that this sort of repeated idea, and that seems to be when you're saying it's you go from one room to another, literally through the doorway, and then you're encountering the same thing. So as we step through these different scenes, they're basically the repeating archetypes that you're constantly finding yourself back at center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the center is everywhere and the circumference is actually nowhere, is, I think, the message. And this is how it's described in, the old text. it's fucking weird. Like, wow, big palace is never ending. And so in a sense, it's a trap. Because if as long as you're just fascinated with the one room to the... if as long as there's no, like, intense desire to get beyond the thing, it's like THX 1138.
Right,
you know,
right.
As long as you remain, you know, satisfied with this little network, then it's like it just goes on like that.
So literally, so it'd be almost like I can't get no satisfaction. It's actually the ideal.
It's perfect. That's a perfect explanation. Yeah, totally.
I totally see that. I mean, this is, I guess, why I was saying, like, so return to center is the is the reboot, is the baseline. It's the touchstone of the labyrinth. So you can, you know, you can return here, but then you have to take excursions out. And that's why I was saying the cards then to be reshuffled, or the I Ching to be, you know, cast the coins again. It's instead of it just being a linear story, it's designed to be broken up. And I think ultimately that's this idea of, like, instead of being fascinated, now remix it and make excursions out. Instead of being fascinated with the monomyth, to sort of recycle and things like that. You're saying not being satisfied with it. Fuck, there was something. Oh my god, I lost it. It was something that I had, like, a minor epiphany in there. Don't worry about it. Ah, fuck.
So there's the argument in terms of Patanjali. So the well, I don't know. I might get in trouble with some Bhagavad Gita enthusiasts or whatever, or some people who are really, you know, into the Vedas or something. But as far as I know, Patanjali is pretty much the oldest recorded explanation of yoga. And then the term yoga, as we know it from Sanskrit, came out of Patanjali, right? And his whole thing, if you want to talk about center, you know, it's a very complex system, but to break it down as simply as possible, he has levels of enlightenment and liberation, right? So there's all these different levels to samadhi, and then there's moksha, to use a Vedantic term to bring it in, which is the ultimate liberation, right? And so you have relative centering, which they call samyan, which is if you take your consciousness and you bring everything to a single point within and connecting that single point in the core of your head with whatever it is that you're perceiving outwardly. Basically, you make, it's like a, and it's actually called a lightning flash is how it translates. And it's a perception that's basically like to the most central point of the thing, you bring all the consciousness on every level. And so, and then that process of samyan basically brings you to a place where you go deeper and deeper, receding back into the most central core of existence, right? And so they also, they have this notion of viveka kyakti, which is the discriminative intellect, which perceives the different levels of prakriti, which is material existence, and pierces the veils of prakriti to recognize what is not purush, which is the spirit. So it's a path of negation. So you say neti neti, which is not this, not this. And in the negation is a simultaneous affirmation on another level, so that you never actually see the highest ever, because it's not perceptible. If it were perceptible, then it wouldn't be the highest. And that's the whole point. And you'll see that same idea in Buddhism, like straight up, like talk to especially esoteric Buddhists on that matter. They're like, you know, it's always before, 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 before. Paragat, paragat, paragat in Sanskrit, right? So there's that notion that, you know, when we say go back to center, but really the highest of all that, which would be Kaivalya, is like basically your death. There's no being an absolute zero, because there's always another level, no matter what. And that's why there's this emphasis on humility. So whatever level you reach, you never take that to be the highest. You keep it in the perspective that the highest is always, you know, way beyond my crown, or anything my crown could envelop,
Yeah.
you know. So I definitely take stock in that view. I resonate, you know.
Oh, definitely. There was even, I mean, yeah, I've heard it voiced in different ways. You know, basically people saying the same thing, but that that's something that really does strike a chord with me. I mean, this is ultimately, I think, one of the reasons I have a little bit of an issue with the word God is like when people talk about God, it's like, to me, it's not that I don't believe in this highest, you know, the highest of high. It's that we can't comprehend it. So to talk about it as if we understand, that's not God to me.
Right.
Anytime someone can talk about God, it's like, no, that can't be God. If you're right. Like, if it's actually God, it's bigger than that.
Right. Which is what's been like, that's the thing. That's what the Torah has to say.
Yeah.
It's the funniest thing when you're dealing with, you know, fundamentalists,
right.
Which I've had to deal with quite a bit in my life, you know, as like, you're like, no, it's your God covers Moses's eyes and moves past, and all he sees is his back parts. What are we talking about here? There is no seeing God. And if you think you do, then you're looking at a mental idol, which is the first fucking commandment. Do not put any gods before me. Mm-hmm. Not put any gods before me means don't put anything and represent that this is somehow that, you know?
Right.
Don't. You know, and so that's the whole thing. Don't fucking, you know, but then they take it as idolatry is oversimplified. They see it as, oh, you build a mental idol. You're like, you know, you know, that's idolatry. It's like, no, any thought in the way is idolatry. Good luck trying to get around that.
Right.
Like everything.
Literally everything we do is trying to represent what we think it is, but then we just end up very often getting fixated on whatever, on the, you know, signifier rather than the signified, right? The
mm-hmm.
And so it's a very, very hard thing to get out of. And like you said, it can be a trap. The place where you go for that understanding, where it is like, Doth is surrounded by six spherod. So that sort of hexagram is formed around it.
Are you saying Doth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is surrounded by the hexagram.
Mm-hmm.
So that,
right. So it's Tiferet for that matter.
Sure.
Its own
yeah.
Way, if you include Da'at,
right,
which is the false crown is why that would be called that. So the top of the hexagram in its place. It's not the real crown. And then that's thought, and then that's universe.
Yes.
That's the way that it's communicated. It's also a hall of mirrors, is how it's described. A Da'at.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're like, this it just goes on for eternity. Yeah, Da'at is one of the more interesting. Right now, my rabbi and I are translating a section of a book called The Garden of Pomegranates by Rama, which is where Israel Regarde titled a book of his called The Garden of Pomegranates, which is like a sink wink to Rama, even though he never says anything about Rama.
Right.
No, he can't read Hebrew, you know, Israel Regarde. Same thing with Crowley, same thing with Eliphas Levi. Like, they can read certain words, but they can't, like, pick up the old text and go through it. They're just, that's, you know, whatever. But they still have an appreciation and have studied through other translations and things. But this book has never been translated into English at all. And so, you know, we're going through a chapter right now on mirrors and translating it. So he's translating. I read it, and then he translates it, and I write it down. And simultaneously, we're looking up words left and right, you know, that are the more obscure because it's old Hebrew. It's not like, you know, people read Hebrew now. It's different, you know, but biblical Hebrew and Aramaic, a lot of Aramaic. You know, but it's fucking far out, like, the way that they deal with mirrors, the idea of a mirror. This is the first time, I mean, I've been studying with him for so many years, and this is the first time we've ever attempted to write anything down. We always just study together, you know, and translate together, but we never record it.
Yeah.
And so it's really exciting time, because we're, you know, whatever, 17, 18 pages into this translation, so I'm eventually going to post it. I'm going to write it out more than just longhand and get it out there. But there was a section on Da'at, which I would like to almost go back and read over again and write it down, even though it's really long, just because it's so, it's pretty poignant, you know, the idea of the palace and the mirrors and this whole, like, endless repetition that's, like, it's like jumping out. Oh, have you ever seen Revolver? Is that a Guy Ritchie movie?
No.
Highly recommended.
Okay.
But there's a whole thing with his, he has an ego breakdown in an elevator where it keeps popping up as like, that he's different, you know? It's like, no, it's like coming in the back door kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
It's like, that's how Da'at is described. It's like, oh no, but I'm different over here. Oh, but I'm different over here. It's like constantly like, no, I got so much to offer. You don't even know.
You know? I like how even a revolver is a six shooter. It has... It's six chambers.
Right. It's not a mistake. He's a Kabbalist.
Yeah.
Because he was with, he's just right when he got with Madonna. Right. So Madonna is studying this different version of Kabbalah, but whatever. It's a mistake. You can call it Kabbalah, you know. But every character in it corresponds to the tree. He plays with the tree in all these different ways. Admittedly so. Like, he's recorded as saying
that
his whole movie is based off of Kabbalah. So it's pretty cool.
That's really, really interesting. So the whole of mirrors, you know, we sort of take it. It's interesting to me, like, just like, you know, in The Shining or any, you're familiar with, like, you know, early, like, the Timothy Leary, Ram Dass sort of idea of, like, what they called game play, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I have expecting it to be right here. I got The Game of Life somewhere around here. You read that?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what I'm talking about. It is the idea of, like, we're entering this as a game. Yeah. So, ultimately, the whole of mirrors, we go, I mean, you know, here in the West, we have these carnivals and what we call amusement parks, and you go into the whole of mirrors as a thing of entertainment, even in, right, mazes, you know, we have in kids' activity books, oh, do the maze, or in The Shining, of course, he enters the maze, and the only way, and Jack gets lost in there, he gets lost in that hole of mirrors, in his sort of mind trap of all his different, you know, it seems to me like this is all equatable as a sort of vision quest, right, where he starts to lose his mind and starts to perceive different things, but doesn't know how to handle it. So he succumbs to the demons out in the wilderness. And even the idea that the Overlook Hotel is so removed from everything, it's so isolated, that's basically stepping out into the wilderness to have your vision quest. Mm-hmm. And so, again, no mistake that he's there on top of an Indian burial ground.
Mm-hmm.
But he gets lost in that hole of mirrors and gets stuck there, probably why he's always been there. When we see at the end of the movie, you've always been the caretaker here, and he's in the old photos. He's even stuck in the labyrinth. He's literally trapped in that hole of mirrors and cannot get out. And Danny is the one who escapes by sort of walking backwards, by stepping out, you know, in through the outdoor sort of thing, or out through the indoor.
Right. I was kind of looking at it like from Oedipus' standpoint, only in the sense of that nothing can basically save you from your own fate. I look at it in terms of destiny, and the reason why he's Jack is that he's everybody. It's like Mr. Smith. It's like you're every man. So, but that basically, as far as our physicality is concerned, there's a part of us that there's no way out of this.
Yeah,
you're part of the network, sure. And you can't escape it. It's like the end of the fountain on the Malkuth level when you see that he's gets absorbed back into nature when he eats of the tree. He expects to live forever to mean something completely different. Not that I, you know, just... there's no part where one ends and one's environment begins.
Exactly.
And so, in a sense, he's Jack Frost, you know, there at the end, because he's, you know, experiencing what we all end up experiencing, you know, to an extent, where we're one with our environment, we're where there's no animation beyond a certain point. Eventually, you go into rigor mortis, like you die.
But that's fascinating. Like if you look at, say, like, you know, the Beltane ritual, where it literally is Jack Frost, the Green Man, you know, this idea of Jack, who then has to, you know, his winter form, the Winter King, has to die to go through the fire and be reborn as the Green Man. So he needs to be born anew. Now, ultimately, in the Shining novel, his, you know, one of his biggest jobs is this idea of the boiler. And people always take this to like be like built up pressure, like he's just building and building and building, like it's like as like a metaphor for his temper or something, like mm-hmm. this rage is building up and he needs to let off steam. But we could also look at it as the boiler, you know, this is the heat source. This goes back to what we said at the beginning, the idea of the fool who has to rekindle the fire. And ultimately, by not rekindling the fire is how he gets frozen in place. By not becoming the fool again, I think this again was like this idea of becoming fascinated by it, you get stuck in it. And then the fool is just able just to step off the cliff and just go like, I'm just, you know, you're essentially freeing yourself. You've rekindled that fire. And ultimately that jumping off the cliff or walking off the cliff is that leap of faith. It is, you know, it's sort of another, I wonder, like, there's this idea of walking across the invisible path. Like you see, like in like a lot of cartoons, right? Like two people run off a cliff and one keeps walking and the other one looks down and falls. And even they did it in Indiana Jones' Last Crusade, right? Where his leap of faith, he had to step, but there was this invisible bridge. And we look at the Tree of Life, there is a sort of, there isn't a bridge over Da'ath, but maybe there is, it's just not, there's a way to cross over it. Well, there's the Rainbow Bridge, of course, there's the middle pillar, but I wonder if just this idea of to cross the abyss, you maybe need a little bit of that foolishness to even see that it's there, or to even trust that it's there.
Or to see that it's folded into itself, and there is actually no reality other than the reality that's inseminated,
right?
With Da'at. Da'at doesn't have a reality that's not borrowed. So it's the power of the of belief,
right,
is Da'at in the first place. And the fact that it has the coordinates that it has to do with, well, there are these dynamics, and the only way that you can work to create the perception that is not an ultimate reality but a relative perception is through these dynamics. And if they're unconscious, all the better as far as the structure is concerned.
Correct, yeah.
Because it's in the unconscious that things are held in place, right? So like if you learn to do anything, it eventually becomes unconscious. So like if you go to drive a car for the first time, you know, it's like it's, everything feels all awkward, and then eventually it builds a momentum because things fall into place. And that's habits. That's like, and it's like neurological connections and things determine the perception. So you make these neurological connections and then they become in place, and then that's the unconscious, right? So this is where like the whole Jungian thing comes into play big time, because you end up with, you can only generate these perceptions through dualities. The only way to take a step up a ladder is to take one foot, move it up, and then follow it with the other,
yeah,
and keep building like that. So you have to work with these opposites, you know, and if the opposites are in opposition in your mind, then all the better, because it won't, things won't get questioned to the degree, they won't get reconciled and become static again. So you can keep this spiral moving.
Exactly. And
generate,
exactly,
holograms through that. But the tree itself is not the way that we take it, all broken apart. The Shekinah, which is the Malkut, is one with Tiferet, which is the air. So you have the female and the male are actually united. And that's what is referred to by the European occultists as the chemical wedding, that alchemy,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yes.
The two back together. But then Keter itself is also Malkut. The crown is the base. Base is the crown. But then they meet at Tiferet. The whole thing is meant to be a seed of life. And then it keeps dividing itself in order to multiply, because to divide and multiply are the same thing.
Yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Like cell growth. And so the thing is actually meant to be all folded. It's just like Stargate when he's like, oh, well, you know, it's like you're folding space and Dune to travel without moving. That's, and actually it's not, I don't feel like it's a mistake with Dune that it's the worms. The translation for how you'd say worm in Hebrew has the same exact gematria as chesed, which is opposite gevura, right? So
okay.
That is the worm. They refer to it as a worm. There's all these little occult jokes in the Gemara and stuff where they're talking about chesed being the worm. And it's like, well, what does chesed have to do with a worm? And so that's the whole message in Dune, is that you ride the snake. You ride the worm. You don't...
The snake is... Ride the snake. The snake is long. 7 miles.
7 miles. The ot.
Yeah.
You fold it. So it's like you can keep fighting this thing, or you can, or you know, you can let it do what it wants to do, which is to be reunited.
Yeah.
And so Jack, in a sense, is fighting it. And so he's Jack in the box. He's in the cube of space.
Yeah.
And he's fighting that he's in the cube of space. He's trying to get away from it. And it's in him trying to get away from it that he ends up getting stuck in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you have to yield to overcome. You can't fight to overcome. And mankind is just like fucking fighting to overcome. We're like, we think that that's how we're going to get somewhere. And it's a complete misconception.
Absolutely.
It's a lie.
Now, something I just recently found out is the old English, the idea was that they used worm as the word for dragon. So like there was this town where I was doing some reading on the mythology of Saint George, who, you know, this guy who plays the dragon. Mm-hmm. And so there's this town called Worm something, like Wormingham Tam or something, you know, some British British name. And they were saying that the word worm was what they used for dragon. So it's the same idea. So that was like where he slayed the dragon, right? But this was interesting to me because in a book that I wrote 2 years ago, I have a character called the Worm. And it's a worm that flies. So it's basically what I was kind of playing on in my modern take on it was this idea that it's Quetzalcoatl, you know, it's this flying serpent. But I had this idea when I was a little kid, this character, I don't know, this flying worm. It was just like this like vision that like never let me go. And you know, and we could take this as something like sexual and all that sort of stuff, but I think for me it was just something else altogether. And so I end up revisiting this character that I thought about since I was a kid, and basically there's like a whole bunch of them, and basically at the end it does become something sexual of like they are both missiles. They're like what's going to destroy the world. They're like falling like missiles. They're like these living weapons. So they're like falling and they're going to destroy everything. But in this moment, they also become sperm and they are able to seed something. So it's like there's this destruction and creation as sort of two sides of the same thing, whatever we want it to become. And, of course, with an actual insemination, only one makes it. So this thing happens where everyone thinks it's going to be destroyed, and then they all turn into sperm, and then basically there's just one left. There's just one left, and he not only gains sentience, but actually, like... reaches sort of an enlightened state and then returns out from it literally to save the life. He goes, it's sort of this bodhisattva figure that comes back literally just to save this character. That when I started the book, I thought this character was going to die at the end. And I got to the end and I just couldn't do it. I was like, no, I can't do it. So I have this character kind of come back to just save the life of this character that I was going to kill off. And so the idea that Chesed is mercy. So this worm literally is like, no, I can't do it. I need to, I have felt compassion for this character that I've been writing for 300 pages. And I was like, I can't do it. So I have this worm sort of come in almost deus ex machina, you know, to sort of save this character. But literally was a moment of absolute mercy on my behalf that I just felt compassion for this character. So that's really interesting on a personal sync level that I didn't intend to put that in there.
That's great. I just had a flash of Poltergeist 2, where he drinks the tequila, and that's how the worm gets into the house. He drinks the worm.
Right, right, right.
And then he regurgitates it. I don't know. I've been thinking about Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2 and connecting it with The Shining. I think that Poltergeist, I would question if the amount of connections between the two is intentional or not. They seem like they're totally like these extreme complementary pieces there.
I thought it was really interesting that you caught it's 2:37 on the clock when the spirit first comes through the TV.
Yep, and it's on a burial ground, and the sequel to Poltergeist with the fucking telephone, you know, you saw that little clip there. I don't know if you remember that part where the grandma calls the little girl on the telephone.
No.
So it's on Mask of God. It's towards the beginning of my section there. Just a little clip of Carol Ann getting a phone call on a toy phone. So she's got her little toy phone on the floor, and she picks it up, and she's all, "Grandma?" It's like, and it's perfect in terms of the uncanny and what the whole message was, the uncanny with what generates, you know, what is that fear of the disembodied spirits, for one, but then the inanimate objects that aren't supposed to have a reality to them, and then they're real. It fucks with you,
yeah.
You know, but then Freud was exploring why exactly is the deepest reasons why this actually does fuck with you, you know. What is this really coming from? Because we know the fear, but we don't always question enough, like, what is the core of why this is so frightening? So, but yeah, the whole, I need to rewatch Poltergeist 2, because I keep having these images come up, even though I haven't seen it in many years. But with that, I feel like there was this whole thing with the Indians. They go to an Indian does this whole seance thing, and to connect them back with Carol Ann, and just, I don't know, weird shit.
So I'm sorry I didn't see that video. Like, often particularly when the blog posts are long, I don't take the time to watch all the videos.
Oh, yeah. No,
you know, it's like, all right, I'll come back to that. And then it's like, oh, there's still more. So I don't always watch all the videos. But that's huge, because to me that was, again, through Stephen King. And Stephen King does repeat a lot of his image. I don't know if you've ever read any of his books, but he repeats a lot. He sort of always kind of comes back to repeating ideas. But he, I was talking about that story of his, The Regulators, where it is a toy phone, and it's basically the same thing. It's like, it's this like autistic child with telepathic abilities and all this stuff. It sounds like The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, the kid communicates through a toy phone. Mm-hmm. So there's something.
She's a Shakina.
How is the phone the Shakina?
Oh no, the little girl, the child.
Oh, in Poltergeist. So,
yeah, in Poltergeist.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I see that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like big time, because Shakina goes into exile and is put in Malkuth and wants to be reunited, and this is the whole thing, like, you know, and who's keeping her there but the Beast? So it can't be any more perfect,
right?
You know, on as far as the symbolic level of it, and that it's in the house, and that the house is bait. Bait is the house. And you have the window of the house, which is Hay, and you have the door of the house, which is Dalit. It's basically this whole structure that is the tarot is itself a house. And so where is the Shakina in the house? And it's like, no, she's pushed to the other side, is what they call it. So the sequel to Poltergeist is The Other Side.
Yes.
It's just on so many levels, it's just so perfect, you know. So, yeah, and also that it's America. They had this whole emphasis on the before the television goes out at night, they play the Star Spangled Banner or whatever, and they have all this American patriotic imagery.
Right.
And then they're built on this graveyard. it's like America is built on a fucking graveyard. You know, this is the whole thing I trip out on. It's like we slaughter the Indians and then we pretend like nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
And it's like in the midst. And so that's like the worms coming through. It's like waiting for the worms. You know, it's like something's rotting under here and we're all pretending like it's not. And that has a karmic effect. And then not only that, but we structure the whole country after the Babylonian squares, all with everything resting on the 13th square, which is the Shekinah, being that it's Venus. So it's like we take the goddess and we use all, basically we're sucking all the energy to build the tower. So I trip out on the reason why the Tower of Babel is a tower is because of the way that the Babylonian squares work is in a funnel. So they're supposed to be folded like a cylinder and you go around and it steps
yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's totally the fucking thing. And then you lay one planet on the other, and then that's 666. 666 for the sun, the Babylonian sun square. Everything rests upon, depends on the 666 square, because all the other planets go inside of it. And then everything connects through 13, which is the goddess. So basically you have the goddess in the center of the sun, right? And so it's like, it's perfect. Who's keeping Carol Ann there but the fucking beast, which is the sun? It's just like, I don't know.
But so this idea, do you see it as the goddess is one of the things that I mean, you know, the same idea of like building on a burial ground is that we've literally building on top of the goddess. It's like, where, or are we sucking out, or is she one of the things that we've also, like, I don't know, you know, this idea of the beast, I keep thinking it's like sort of like the dungeon, you know, it's sort of like, so we have, you could take this to like the Matrix or all these different things of like, that's your power source. You sort of keep imprisoned and then you're, which allows you to build up and rise up. But it's sort of only by, or very often by repressing that other force. So it's sort of like,
that's right,
building on top of that. And what's interesting to me, I don't know if you saw, I put up on Facebook this idea that I was looking at your Babylonian squares and now the World Trade Center site in those, what they call the footprints, they're now calling them voids. They're literally calling them voids. And they're just basically these squares, the footprint or the outline of the building with another square inside of it. And it's like a waterfall going down. So instead of being the tower up, it's a void going down, but it's a square within a square.
Weird. No, I didn't see that. I'll look at that. Huh. Yeah. So to quote Jim Morrison, a beast caged in the heart of the city.
Yes. Yeah.
And he also says a beast car locked against morning. It's shutting itself out from the actual dawn. So it has a false dawn is a reoccurring theme that I've been coming across where there's like a false sun. It's like Gray Seal,
mm-hmm,
by Elton John. Have you ever heard that? You know what I'm talking about?
Gray Seal.
I'll send it to you. I've been tripping out on the lyrics of Gray Seal. It's actually Great Seal. If you listen to the song, you can hear you saying Great Seal. So tell me, Great Seal, how does it feel to be so wise, to see through an eye that only sees what's real? Tell me, Great Seal. And he's talking to the pyramid, right?
Yeah.
But then the lyrical content, like all of it, is just, it's one of my absolute favorite songs, and it's on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which is where he's stepping. There's a fake yellow brick road. It's a poster,
yes,
of the fucking road, but it's like still real because he can step through it. So it's like, it's an illusion, yet it's real at the same time. So you can take that how you will. But basically on the big screen, they showed us the sun, but never bright in life as the real one. It's never quite the same as the real one. So it's like there's like this representation of like the sun, but it's not really the sun. What are we talking about here? And so it's like the it's real, but it's not real. And what effect does that have? And what does that mean exactly? But, yeah, I trip out on it a lot.
That's really interesting. That's really, like, yeah, so obviously, you know, here he's playing with, again, the Oz imagery with Yellow Brick Road. But it is that, you know, that stepping through the movie screen in 2001, if the monolith is the movie screen, it's the, you know, even in that Regulator story where he's bringing his ideas to, he's sort of stepping into his favorite TV show, or he's actually, what's happening is he's modeling sort of changing the world around him to model his favorite TV show, which sometimes I wonder with, you know, all these sort of really great minds who are figuring out how sort of reality seems to work. And I would argue, I think part of that is that we are part of the creation of that, that we're kind of creating our own reality. But we're getting so locked down on media that I wonder if there isn't a sort of either, again, whether it's a warning or just what is, but that we, it's that idea of, does art imitate life or does life imitate art, where we are making our artistic creations or our favorite movies, our favorite TV shows, we're sort of bringing those elements into our real world, either through very literal actions. You know, there was this idea like, oh, you know, violent video games made kids violent, or, you know, like, oh, this is like, there's that straight up just really baseline, like, okay, influence, the artistic influence. But I'm talking on a more esoteric level of where we are becoming fascinated with that pyramid, or with that palace rather, or these visions, the shadows on the wall. We're becoming fascinated with them and sort of getting stuck in them and modeling our world after it, instead of perhaps stepping through the wall, you know, where Elton John has to, you know, like, all right, I'm going to go here.
Yeah, totally. And he's saying goodbye, Yellow Brick Road, which is the gold leading to the paper currency. So it's something that had apparently some real value.
Right.
It's got weight and gold. We walked down to the banks and gave away our gold and traded it for paper. And how the fuck did that happen? And it came out of fear, because we're coming out of the depression, and whatever solution you tell us so that we don't have to experience
exactly
this, we'll do it.
But I also, yeah. I totally understand what you're saying there, but I want to just question, you were saying the idea of like the false sun, like if this maybe is the same thing, because to the alchemist, the symbol for gold and the sun is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we've given our sun away. If that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense, yeah. We traded it for the green. Yeah. It's it's got interesting implications in terms of, was that strategized? Like, is that like, Lucis Trust, which is the headquarters is the UN, right? Which is an offshoot of Theosophy from Blavatsky. So Blavatsky, Theosophy, Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum wrote The Wizard of Oz. He's a theosophist. And then you have these people that basically are the people behind the people organizing the whole fucking UN, like coming up with this idea in the first place, you know, are completely connected. So I have to wonder, like, and this is also the Occupy movement. Occupy movement was started by the Lucis Trust, not fucking Adbusters, like we were told. And so I wonder about that, too. It's very strange.
But do you think it's possible, like, so if you have Frank L. Baum, who basically, you know, if he's encoding his story, if we're to believe this modern idea that the gold, this represents, you know, the gold and the silver shoes, and that the green is the illusion. I'm open to that interpretation, but I also think that reading it, if like the actual novel has some much more interesting way, like other implications there.
Yeah, you were talking about the goggles that they wear, and everything is green that they put on the goggles, and they see it this way.
Yeah, it's almost like a reverse. You ever see They Live?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Right. So it's like, instead of you put on the glasses to see how it really is, it's like, in order to step into the city, you have to put on the goggles that make everything fake. You know, so it's like,
right.
The Emerald City isn't green. That's the thing. It's like, nothing in Emerald City is green. So this idea of, and again, this could be paper money. We could say that, like, green implies growth. So that's why they colored it that way, but then underneath it's really empty. So there's nothing wrong, wrong with the green color. It's that the green is an illusion. It's not actually growth. It's just, you know, it's dead. It's literally dead underneath. It's dead paper.
Right.
We've killed the green and pulverized it and then dyed it green again and go, here you go. Here's some growth. So again, building on top of the graveyard, it seems like that's literally what, and we actually put a fucking pyramid on it. Like we're going to build on this dead, dead thing.
Right. And so the other level is Glinda, the good witch, and the fucking evil witch, which the only explanation given, at least in the film, I don't know about the book, but that the evil witch is evil is because she's ugly.
Yeah.
Only evil witches are ugly. Just drop a fucking house on her sister. We know nothing about this other witch. All we've seen is her legs shrivel up and are told, you know, in the dark side of the moon that in the end it's only round and round and her legs shrivel up. And then, you know, Glinda, what does Glinda want? She wants Dorothy to make it to the Emerald City, you know? Go to the Emerald City. What does she get when she goes to the Emerald City? She sees a fucking wizard who's keeping a whole city under an illusion.
Right.
He's lying to the whole city and controlling them through that illusion. He has no real magic. All his tricks are fakery. Oh, you want a brain? Oh, here's a diploma. Oh, you want a heart? Oh, here's a fucking clock. Like, he has no real magic. He's behind this fucking curtain. Meanwhile, the quote-unquote evil witch can fucking manifest fire from her hand and throw it. It's like completely in touch with the elements. When Dorothy goes to the Emerald City, she's told to fucking kill the witch and get her broom and bring it back because the wizard wants her broom. Like, she kills the fucking the witch and then everyone bows to her.
In the movie, it's definitely this idea of like, it's very much an American propaganda piece of like, hey, overthrow someone, other country's leader, right? We're going to drop a fucking house on them, steal their jewels, all their precious stuff, and then all the little people of the country will praise us as liberating them. Oh, yay, we're all going to dance around and sing songs. Thank you for delivering democracy and freedom. Mm-hmm. Now, hey, wait, not only do we have to overthrow that country, but did I tell you about Saddam Hussein? Go find his cousin, another member of the Axis of Evil, the Wicked Witch of the West, and go kill her too. But part of me wonders, and again, I'm just throwing it out there, is if they were familiar with Theosophy, if they understood a lot of these esoteric ideas, were they using it to control people, or was it an attempt to try and show people what's wrong? Like, if it really was that this is a, if Wizard of Oz is a symbolic thing of saying, hey, this is what happens when you lose it, and that it is an illusion, then that would seem like that guy was making an attempt to show people what was wrong, not to control them.
Right.
But
it's the hope that people in time, at least, will pick up on it, because it only has value if they realize it themselves.
Correct.
If you tell them what it is, they won't get it, and they'll fucking crucify you. The best you can do is plant the seeds.
Right. But ultimately, like, so then, like, if you have these people then going to the UN, and to me, the UN is a dastardly organization. I mean, it's just proven to be a really, you know, a strong arm of the empire. But I have to wonder, you know, just like anything else, if the idea, like, I don't think a lot of the ideas of Theosophy are interesting, but that doesn't, you know, just because they then go off to start, you know, United Nations and things like this, doesn't make them inherently evil. It means that they were probably trying to do something good, but in these efforts, as we've seen with every, this is my point, is like, you know, people get upset about the Illuminati. I mean, obviously, the ideas of Illuminism are actually really fascinating and, if actually followed, could be very interesting. You know, yield very positive results for the world. But ultimately, some guy reads, you know, something, goes, yeah, I get that. Yeah, I'm perfect. I can rule this shit. You know, it's like we can, any human beings are flawed and will find a way to distort anything. We see people killing in the name of Jesus Christ who says, turn the other cheek. And somehow people found a way to say, onward Christian soldiers. People found a way to turn, you know, alchemy and illuminism, these ideas of perfecting yourself, into, hey, let's go trick the world into, you know, taking our paper money and we'll steal their gold. You know, people found a way to turn all these things into ugly actions. But ultimately, I still go back to the idea that the ideas themselves are not ugly. The actions of the people that people do in the name of that idea are usually pretty dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't even I don't with the so there's a really great video series from Rob Agger on The Shining. And particularly The Gold Room. Have you seen that?
No.
You know who Rob Agger? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I've seen that he's done different breakdowns of stuff, different Kubrick stuff, but I've never seen something on The Gold Room.
That's the newest video, I think, that he's done. And he basically is taking The Gold Room and looking. He thinks that the photograph that you see at the end with Jack is actually... what's his fucking name? I should know this. It's the president who basically established the... Oh, Woodrow Wilson.
Okay, yeah.
He thinks that character... Because the photograph is a real photograph. And they basically airbrushed in Jack Nicholson's face onto the character. It's the only thing that's changed is his fucking face. And he goes to the Kubrick archives and he's looking for it. He can't find it, you know? But basically... He gives a pretty good fucking argument, and at the end of the first video, when I saw it, I was like, I don't know if that's Woodrow Wilson. How the fuck does he know that? Why does
he hasn't found
that?
But he's never found the original photo.
No one has.
Right.
It's like, who knows where it is. It's probably in the archive somewhere, but it's huge archive. Kubrick's archive? Jesus. You know? It's just so many boxes for days. But, that the family, that the people who are surrounding him look remarkably like the Woodrow Wilson's family. Super weird. And so the argument for that would be, it's the Gold Room. It's, you know, it's them establishing the Federal Reserve and what that means for them. It's you know, it's an interesting premise. It's worth watching. The Shining, Rob Agger, Gold Room. Maybe I'll just send it to you.
And that would explain why, when he goes to that room, that he's basically making a deal with the devil. And he even says,
"Yeah, his money's no good here.
Your money's no good here. Exactly. Your money's no good here."
Yeah, pulls out a dollar, paper currency, and they go, "Oh, your money's no good here. This is the Gold Room."
Yeah, exactly. It actually does make an interesting amount of sense.
Yeah, I also think about Jack in terms of the jackrabbit in Alice in Wonderland and how you have these two rabbits. You have the white rabbit, who's basically royalty. He's a well-to-do, you know, aristocrat. And then you have the fucked-up psychedelic jackrabbit who basically wants to be proper and on the up. And so I've
March
been considering
Hare. March Hare, right?
March Hare. Who's a jackrabbit, right? March Hare, isn't that the same thing?
I believe so, yeah.
So it's the... Basically, I've been thinking about things in terms of that it's only through us imitating the higher echelon that the higher echelon remains in the position that it's in. Because as long as we're trying to fuck over our neighbor or have a one-up, so to speak, going to get mine, that's what keeps the whole structure going. If we weren't imitating the higher ups and doing our events and our fucking everything as a reproduction of what goes on, that basically it's like an arm of a hurricane and everything depends on what's happening before it because it's cause and effect. And so what keeps the thing rolling is the imitation. And so I consider that the March Hare is basically like imitating what's happening with the, you know, he wants to be at the fucking tea party and be all well-to-do, but he's all fucked up because he's not having the same experience that they are, you know? So I don't know. I was looking at Jack, like he walks into the Gold Room, like he's like, you know, oh yeah, I'm, whatever, you know, he's got kind of an attitude in it, and it's like he's not, it's kind of a trap because he's not really ever going to get there. You know, I also think of Mulholland Drive in the same respect too, that it's like the fool behind the fucking dumpster with the cube, with the, you know, the tefillin cube, the fucking kabah cube, you know, he holds the answer, and all these people in the Hollywood echelon like think that they're trying to get something, you know, that's like they'll be given the fucking secret knowledge or whatever, but really it's the fucking crazy ass guy that terrifies everyone behind the dumpster that's pointing out that it's all a great big fucking insane joke, you know, and they don't want to look at that, so they, you know, they'd rather die than face what it actually means, you know, because it goes against everything that they're working for. It would be humiliating.
Yeah, so. And isn't it the idea? I mean, we could put a slight positive spin on that is, the idea of the Fisher King, when you know, they say, we were just talking about Robin Williams as the genie. Well, he also is the Fisher King, and he tells a story where the king sends out all his men looking for the chalice, and the like bum of the kingdom basically says, like, he, you know, the king is thirsty, and he hands him the thing. He goes, how did you find this chalice? How did you, you know, where did you, oh, my finest men couldn't find this thing. And he says, well, I wasn't looking for it. I just knew that you were thirsty. So, yeah. You know, it's like the divine fool who had it all along, and just in that act of mercy was able to produce it. But actually, it was when we said looking for the way out is how you get trapped in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going on this grail quest and you think you're going to find the answers. But ultimately, what they always find is that they have the treasure all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The chalice has been coming up a whole lot lately. I keep thinking about the lust card of Crowley and how the Scarlet Woman of the Apocalypse holds up the chalice, and then you have these snakes all moving towards it, and chalice being shell or husk, and the clipote, which are the outside forces, being shell or husk, and that it's the container, you know, and then the way that the feminine has been, we've removed ourselves from the reality. It's like we're projecting this thing, we're giving that power, which is a mass manipulation of the thing, which we all agree on. It's like mass insanity. That's how the psychology of fascism works, you know. It's basically through a agreement of a projection, so we project it in this light, and then that becomes what it is that we work off of and what we build from. So
yeah, I mean, that, you know, I think it's interesting, both of us are coming to this idea of you know, recreate, like when you said imitating the elite, is the same idea of life imitating art. And I don't, you know, I personally don't come from the perspective that the art is all, you know, strictly government propaganda and things like that. Plenty of it probably is, just, again, I mean, as an objective statement, I have to figure that plenty of it is made by decisions in marketing boardrooms and stuff like that, or Pentagon boardrooms or wherever. But at the same time, I don't come from the opinion that all of it is. I think plenty of it is really trying to be. I mean, ultimately, to create artwork, you have to tap into something, and you're usually, the people who are creating it are interested in finding some beauty in this world and trying to create that or replicate that. But so, like I said, even though I don't come from that perspective, I just think it's interesting we're both coming to this, again, to this idea of, like, don't imitate it. Don't create your world based on somebody else's vision.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important.
Yeah, there's a George Orwell quote that's, all art is propaganda.
I don't think that's Orwell. That's, I want to say, like, Du Bois or something. it predates Orwell, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, well, maybe he requoted it, and then it was attributed to him from somebody.
But
it's
definitely true. It's definitely true, regardless who the fuck said it.
Right.
It's definitely true. Yeah, because even if you're trying to create a beautiful thing, I mean, you're like, I want you to see the world how I see it. You know, mm-hmm. if I'm trying to create a story of fluffy bunnies prancing around a field, I still am trying to give you this idea like, hey, everything's beautiful and it's nice. I'm trying to sell you on my vision. Or someone who's trying to enlighten people by creating a movie or you know, again, like a book like Wizard of Oz, if he was trying to say, hey, don't get fooled into, you know, giving away your wealth, he was trying to basically create propaganda to oppose somebody else's propaganda. And we just go through this sort of cycle of everyone's putting out their own little piece of propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I liked in Freud's The Uncanny when he was talking about home. I don't know if you read that on the blog, how he was saying basically the energetic or the ultimate degree of the meaning of home would be back in the womb. And then on some level, we all want to return to the womb. And that's kind of what keeps us in this. It's like another Morrison quote, I pressed her thigh and death smiled. It's that the thing that we want the most is also the source of so much fear.
Yeah.
Because life and death are two sides of the same thing. And so that most likely that statement from Morrison is inspired by Life Against Death by Norman O. Brown, which is a book that he, you know, ascribed to and took pretty seriously. It's this thing in psychology that they acknowledge that's basically, you know, what we're the most attracted to is also what we fear the most, because there's a fear of loss. So attachment, fear of loss, they go together, they're hand in hand. And so what's the most promising thing of fulfillment is actually the source of the most fear. So it's a endless mind fuck. So I take it as I take the ought in that way too, going back to what we were saying in terms of the mirror, that you see it this way and then it flips on you, and you see it that way and then it flips on you, and there's really no way to reconcile it. It's not reconcilable except in terms of transcendence, which is directly through. So there's no way around illusion. The only way beyond is directly through. And so that's birth, growth, decay, and death, and facing that to the ultimate degree would be the only way to transcend it, which is what I feel The Shining is trying to fucking push in your face. It's like, you know, see this.
Break you know, on through to the other side.
Completely, yeah.
It's actually a really perfect segue, because I remembered before my little mini epiphany was this idea of when you were saying, you know, one plus one plus one, and I thought of the Beatles lyric, one and one and one is three, got to be good looking because he's so hard to see. And we were talking about sort of invisible pathway. It's so hard to see. It's invisible, right? This middle pillar. Now, I take that one and one and one, the 111 is often is the masculine. It's the three pillars of the Freemasonic tracing board. But if we sort of flip it upside down, it's two legs and a penis. It's like two long pillars and then a smaller pillar in the middle. Flip it upside down, it's two legs and a penis. Now we look at, say, Orwell, room 101. It's the two legs with the hole in the middle. It's the void. It's the womb. So we're always, like, and even Dot, we put, is the high priestess of the Tarot. So she's between the two pillars. So we see, we're always, when you said we're always looking back to go home to the womb, we're looking for the lost city of Atlantis. Well, what is it? It's this watery world between the two Herculean pillars, right? So that, what is that? That's pretty obvious what that is. We lost it. You know, we lost our Eden, our womb-like world that we're trying to get back to. And you know what Atlantis sank. It's like, is that the water breaking? You know, the water runs out and you spill out into this whole other world, and now you're on land. You know, now you're this sort of leggy creature squirming around on the land. But you know, again, I mean, these could be. We want to go back to it, but I also wonder. A part of me just throws out there that, you know, we talk about like a return to like an archaic revival and all this stuff. But if we are to put any credence in an idea of evolution from aquatic creatures to land creatures, it's that same sort of thing that we are exploring new frontiers, and that some, you know, any evolutionary phase or any birthing stage comes with some heavy trauma and some real hardship. And it's not, you know, you don't come into the world in this, you know, beautiful, serene, like just floating down off a cloud. The stork doesn't drop you off. You come to this world kicking and screaming in a bunch of blood and, you know?
Yeah, like a blind cave fish.
Yeah.
Having to, like, face the day. Yeah. So that actually ties in really well with Coates' argument on Atlantis basically being the psychedelic realm that people would enter into with the Blue Lotus.
Correct.
And you could argue the dung ball, which they would get psilocybin from.
Yeah.
So what we know at this point about the Egyptians and what they were about, like in terms of the intense austerity and the fucking practices that they do through the mystery schools and whatnot, that it's like, wow, when you're integrated to this degree, where they're doing all the, basically the yogic practices, and they're doing serious fucking cleansing. And then also what the earth was like at that time in terms of there's no fucking pollution. Like if you wanted to get high, you could get some pretty fucking high. Like we don't even know, you know? And so, and then the idea that there's this whole, that is the Atlantis realm, in the same way that the child, the very young child, before the senses have even started developing, and he's come out of this water world, you know, he's just like, everything's connected, everything's fused, everything is in sync as far as he's concerned. I mean, that's what he's coming out of, is just this state of, you know, ultimate connectivity, you know, and you bring him back to the breast and he gets to hold on to that state for a while, you know, because he's in it. You know, so I think that what happens with the psychedelics is that it brings us back to a similar place, and then things start to fuse together, and we make these connections like no problem. You know, you find the correspondences, not in an intellectual way, but in just a natural way. And so I can only imagine like what things may have, how things may have developed when people were that in touch with that and able to maintain that, along with all these practices, you know,
think about in Egypt. I mean, their whole thing was, for their plant growth, they needed the flooding of the Nile is what brought the new life. So again, it's this, like the water, it's the water of life. It literally is the water of life of like, okay, the Nile overflows, the water rushes in, and that's where we can get new growth. So again, this is like the water breaking. This is the Atlantean sort of myth again. It's that same birthing stage of the water breaking. So when the water overflows, if it keeps on raining, the levee's gonna break.
And Anubis. Yeah. So they're telling what's gonna happen with the Nile due to Sirius.
Yes.
Which is the dog star, which is Anubis, which is the guide to the underworld. The underworld is this realm, the watery, behind the board realm, you know. And so, you know, there's also the notion of Mula Prakriti. So this is like the way that it was explained to me by my teacher, the psychedelic state, Baba Hari Das, so on his board, because he hasn't, at this point, I think it's been 60 years since he's spoken, but basically his explanation for what happens with LSD and other psychedelics is that basically it's not the spiritual realm that you're experiencing. You're experiencing the level of Prakriti, which is the material realm where everything basically syncs up. And that is the closest. Basically, what happens is that the material realm does everything and it's able to reflect the reality of what Purusha is, but it never actually quite makes it because it can't by definition. Otherwise, things wouldn't stand out in space. It requires the distortion for things to stand out. Otherwise, the whole thing is static. But that it has movements towards that in order to basically get us to understand to our highest ability what is happening on the other side that we won't ever get to see because it's always before, where basically there is no birth, growth, decay, and death. But that we have, like, Mula Prakriti is this underworld that mirrors what is beyond to, and it's brings up fear for people to enter into that realm because it goes against all of our coping mechanisms. We project a holographic self to deal with the fact that we aren't able to localize ourselves ultimately. So we create a fake self so that we can use these reference points in order to maintain the structure. But that if you remove that structure, it brings up fear because we have this thing in place to protect ourselves. So that's like the psychedelic experience, why some people experience fear in the different levels of processing entering into that watery realm is due to the structure that we put in place to keep us localized. That makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, and the underwater, that like watery abyss is always thought of in psychology as the unconscious or subconscious, so it equates beautifully there. And even my own thing, what I've been trying to sort of explain, this idea of that the masculine is what builds that sort of Tower of Babel, and the feminine is the void that it sort of collapses into. You know, basically it's seeded by, maybe the masculine is the distortion that's necessary, so the masculine builds its tower up, enters into the void, and then weaves a seed there, and then the tower collapses. After orgasm, the penis collapses back down. So this is the idea of a sort of cycle there, but it's left something new. It's left a seed. And even the Osiris story is when he's cut into pieces, he's thrown, like, well, first he's put into a box, thrown into the river. Then he's then again cut into pieces. And ultimately what happens is his penis is what's left behind. Everything of him is put back together except his penis. Now, a lot of people take, you know, you could take this different ways as, you know, a suppression of the lust instinct or this sexual drive, you know, the sexual distraction. But I would also see it as that same thing, that, like, it's left behind because now the tower has collapsed. Now, by putting his penis into the river, into that void, into that whatever, he's seeding it with new life, and then it's essentially gone. You know, for the moment at least, the erection is gone, and it goes back into this new cycle. But first he has seeded it with life. So I think the masculine principle is the distortion, perhaps. If mm-hmm. we maybe look at it that way, it's like, you know, there is the void, and then of course the masculine, you know, this Yahweh figure says, let there be light. That's the sun is the first thing. And so, of course, the very, you know, masculine figure enters into it. And this is where we've created distortion. We've disrupted it. But through that, we've created something new. I also thought it was interesting that you were talking about the child going to the breast as the sort of return to center. If you saw Stefan Jablonski's chapter in the Sync book, he talks about the nipple is that gold or sun glyph. The circle with the dot in the middle is the nipple. Mm-hmm. So we are always, since infancy, we will always have it ingrained in us. That symbol is the sign of sort of perfection, the sign of like what we're attaining for, what we're questing for. So we want to get back to... you know, we want to get back to Atlantis. We want to get back to that watery abyss, but we also want to, you know, so every alchemist who wants perfection is striving for quote unquote gold, is trying to get back to that nipple, the source of all life, the waters of life or the milk of life is striving to get back to it. But I can see the fact that it's also equated with the sun, that same glyph is the sun, again, goes back to our early thing with the fool rekindling the fire. So that he goes back to that source of life.
So, you know, the ratio of value from gold to silver has always, as far back as we can go, has been directly derived from the relationship of the sun to the moon and the way they operate with each other. And that was actually something that was pointed out in Norman O'Brien's Life Against Death. That's like, they didn't know why it had been consistent for quite a while, or at least certain people who had investigated it, you know, and it was actually pointed out by this guy Lom at one point, that's where indeed derived from, and that we've been consistent about it the whole fucking time, like forever. It's like, well, what, why is there this ratio that we hold? And it's like, oh, the fucking sun and moon. Isn't that interesting that that's our, like, our currency? I happen to just realize I'm holding like change in my hand as I'm saying. I'm looking at my computer and it looks like I didn't bring the cord out to my space out here, so it might die. So
that's okay.
I should either leave or go grab it.
No,
so
I was gonna say, I thought we were just gonna do this for 5 minutes, and I was gonna say I should really get going. I have things to do, but the conversation was too good for me to let go, so
yeah, we were about to leave for the flea market, and then I was like, oh, I got to make a 5-minute call, but I'm sure she's fine. So,
well, give her my apologies and enjoy your day.
Did you record this, by the way?
I did, as a matter of fact, yeah.
Oh, sweet. Nice. This is a good conversation.
I thought it was fantastic, yeah. I'm sweet. Trying to figure out, like, as we were talking, I was trying to figure out how I should handle this. If it seems like the first time we did it, we started at that Doors point and then branched off, and then when you hung up, me and Klaus continued for like another hour. It's sort of like a weird branching point where the first 10 minutes are the same. You know, it's like